Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 3rd, 2021 Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today I'll be reading the following main articles. Omicron reported in Colorado by Meg Wingerter of the Denver Post. U.S. still battling the Delta variant by Heather Hollingsworth of the Associated Press. Rams pay steep price to let football coach go by Sean Keeler of the Denver Post. And data suggests 1 in 44 U.S. children affected by autism by Lindsay Tanner of the Associated Press. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our first story, COVID-19, Omicron reported in Colorado. Woman in Arapahoe County recently went to Southern Africa by Meg Wingerter. Colorado has identified its first known case of the new Omicron variant of COVID-19 in an Arapahoe County resident. But there's no evidence that version of the virus is widespread at this point, and it's still not known how great a risk the new strain poses. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment on Thursday reported the patient, an adult woman, has mild symptoms and is recovering at home. She recently had traveled to countries in Southern Africa where the variant was first identified. Her COVID-19 test was flagged by the Tri-County Health Department for genetic sequencing because of her recent travel. State epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said the woman followed all public health guidelines, including wearing a mask while traveling and getting tested as soon as she developed symptoms. The woman was vaccinated against COVID-19, and enough time had elapsed that she was eligible for a booster shot, but she had not gotten one. People who were in close contact with her have been ordered to isolate, but none have tested positive so far, according to state health officials. Governor Jared Polis said he's not terribly alarmed that an Omicron case has been found, but he urged people to get vaccinated or get booster shots before it becomes widespread. Much remains unknown about the new variant, but indirect evidence suggests it could be more contagious than the Delta variant, which currently dominates in Colorado and much of the world. If we have a few weeks, let's use it to protect ourselves, he said. Overall, Colorado's COVID-19 situation seems to be slowly improving. Hospitalizations for confirmed cases dropped to 1,400 on Thursday afternoon. Capacity remained tight, though, with only 67 care beds and 399 general beds available statewide. Other metrics also showed some improvement. The average number of cases each day has continued to fall, although the decrease hasn't been as steep in the past few days as it was last week. The number of active outbreaks also fell for the first time since mid-July, although it was a decrease of only 3. The positivity rate raised one red flag that this wave may not be over. The percentage of tests coming back positive rebounded somewhat in the past few days after slowly falling for much of November. It's too early to know if Thanksgiving gatherings led to increased spread of the virus, and it's not clear what effect Omicron might have if it becomes widespread. Certainly, we're less worried about exceeding our hospital capacity than we were 2 weeks ago. But this virus keeps throwing spitball after screwball, Polis said. The World Health Organization has classified Omicron as a variant of concern, although much is yet to be known about how great of a threat it poses. Mutations on the virus's spike protein, the part that allows it to enter human cells, suggest it could be more contagious than previous variants and harder for the immune system to recognize. But it will take at least 2 weeks to confirm whether Omicron behaves differently from previous variants. California and Minnesota identified cases of Omicron before Colorado did, and New York announced 5 cases later Thursday afternoon. The Minnesota resident had not left the country, but had traveled to a convention in New York, suggesting at least some spread has happened within the United States. Experts have raised concerns about whether the United States has a clear picture of how far Omicron may have spread, because some parts of the country are doing significantly more testing than others. Colorado does more sequencing than most states. As of Thursday afternoon, Omicron had been found in 36 countries, with cases that were not linked to travel in Canada and 6 Western European countries, as well as South Africa and Botswana. New information from the Netherlands shows the variant was in Europe a week before it was confirmed in South Africa and raised alarms. The State Health Department advises anyone who has traveled internationally to take a test that looks for the virus's genetic material 3 to 5 days after returning. While rapid tests can tell you if you have the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the state can't use them to determine which variant is causing your illness, Herlihy said. COVID-19 cases recently started increasing in South Africa's Gauteng province, which included the cities of Johannesburg and Pretoria, Herlihy said. The spike in cases, which coincides with finding Omicron there, is indirect evidence that the variant may spread more easily, she said. A South African doctor reported her patients who had Omicron generally had mild symptoms, but it's not clear if that reflects a difference in the virus, Herlihy said. Many of the patients were in their 20s, and most people in that age group have mild or moderate symptoms, she said. It also is not clear if the immune system has a harder time detecting Omicron, which would increase the odds it gains a foothold in people who have been vaccinated or recovered from a previous version of the virus. At this point, the World Health Organization expects that people who have been vaccinated still will be protected from severe COVID-19, Herlihy said. The state is sequencing about 15% of positive COVID-19 tests, as well as sampling wastewater to find out what variants are in the community and how widespread they are. The Delta variant still accounts for almost all cases identified in Colorado. But at this point, the precautions are the same for all variants. Get vaccinated, get a booster if you're eligible, wear a mask in public indoor settings, practice social distancing, and stay home except to get tested or get medical care if you're sick. The strategies are the same, she said. And more on the COVID-19 front, the fire that's here, U.S. still battling the Delta variant, by Heather Hollingsworth. While all eyes are on the new and little understood Omicron variant, the Delta form of the coronavirus is not finished wreaking havoc in the U.S., sending record numbers of patients to the hospital in the Midwest and New England. Omicron is a spark that's on the horizon. Delta variant is the fire that's here today, said Dr. Nirav Shah, director of the State Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Maine, where an unprecedented 334 people were in the hospital with COVID-19 as of midweek. The U.S. recorded its first confirmed Omicron infection on Wednesday in a Californian who had been to South Africa, where the variant was first identified a week ago. Several more cases were reported Thursday, 5 in the New York City area, and 1 each in Minnesota, Hawaii, and Colorado, under circumstances suggesting the variant has begun spreading within the U.S. A Minnesota man had attended an anime convention in New York City just before Thanksgiving that drew an estimated 50,000 people. Minnesota officials said he had no history of international travel. That would suggest the variant has begun to spread within the U.S. But there is much that is unknown about Omicron, including whether it is more contagious than previous versions, makes people sicker or more easily thwarts the vaccine, or breaks through the immunity that people get from a bout of COVID-19. For now, the extra contagious Delta variant accounts for practically all cases in the U.S. and continues to inflict misery at a time when many hospitals are struggling with shortages of nurses and a backlog of patients undergoing procedures that had been put off early in the pandemic. The fear is that Omicron will foist even more patients and perhaps sicker ones onto hospitals. For me, it's really just, I can't imagine, said Dr. Natasha Buyan, a family physician in Phoenix, which has also been hit hard. Are we going to see another surge in cases that's even higher than what we're seeing now? What will that do to our health system? What will that do to our hospitals? 2 years into the outbreak, COVID-19 has killed over 780,000 Americans, and deaths are running at about 900 per day. COVID-19 cases and deaths in the U.S. have dropped by about half since the Delta peak in August and September, but at about 86,000 new infections per day, the numbers are still high, especially heading into the holidays when people travel and gather with family. With the onset of cold weather sending more people indoors, hospitals are feeling the strain. Delta is not subsiding, said Dr. Andre Khalil, an infectious disease physician at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Nebraska on Tuesday reported 555 people in the hospital with COVID-19, the highest number since last December when the vaccine rollout was just beginning. Vermont on Thursday recorded its highest daily number of COVID-19 cases at 604, 2 days after hospitalizations hit a pandemic high of 84. New Hampshire, once an early vaccination leader, is now second only to Michigan in the most new cases per capita over the past 2 weeks. In Minnesota, which ranks third for most new cases per capita, the Pentagon sent medical teams last month to two major hospitals to relieve doctors and nurses, and another team is set to arrive Friday. This fourth wave, I can pretty clearly state, has hit Minnesota harder than any of the previous ones, said Dr. Timothy Johnson, president of the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He said hospitals are struggling because of a combination of a lack of nurses, fatigue, and patients undergoing treatments that had to be postponed earlier in the crisis. Now those chickens are coming home to roost a little bit, he said. At Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis, where one of the military medical teams was sent, the number of COVID-19 patients has doubled since September, although it remains below pandemic highs, spokeswoman Christine Hill said. And it's concerning with the holidays coming up, she said. Military teams also have been to Michigan, where hospitals are grappling with more COVID-19 patients than at any other time during the pandemic. Dr. Pauline Park, who takes care of critically ill patients at University of Michigan Health, called the latest surge heartbreaking. One COVID-19 patient, a woman in her 20s, died the week of Thanksgiving. Another, a mother with young children, is on a machine built to take over for her lungs. Arizona, where students in dozens of classrooms have been forced into quarantine, reported more than 3,100 new COVID-19 cases Wednesday, numbers similar to the disastrous summer of 2020. Hospital bed space has fallen to pandemic lows. Buyan said a patient of hers with a blood clot in a lung was discharged instead of being admitted. Other patients are waiting hours in the emergency room. It's just hard because it does feel like we are actually going backward in time, even though we have these vaccines, which are such a great weapon for us, she said. While about three dozen countries worldwide have reported Omicron infections, including India on Thursday, the numbers are small outside of South Africa, which has confirmed more than 170 cases. World health authorities have yet to link any deaths to Omicron. The Delta variant is still causing deep turmoil in Europe, too, including Germany and Austria. South Korea is also seeing a Delta-driven surge that has pushed hospitalizations and deaths to record highs. On Thursday, Germany, where new COVID-19 infections topped 70,000 in a 24-hour period, barred the unvaccinated from non-essential stores and cultural and recreational sites. Lawmakers are expected to take up a general vaccine mandate in the coming weeks. Austria, meanwhile, extended its lockdown. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the measures are necessary because hospitals could become overloaded. The situation in our country is serious, she said. Turning to Colorado sports news, Colorado State University Rams pay steep price to let football coach go by Sean Keeler. Dateline Fort Collins. The timing was not coincidental. On Wednesday night at 11:15 p.m., Joe Parker, athletic director at Colorado State, would have allowed his football coach, Steve Adazio, $5 million as a buyout for terminating Adazio's contract without just cause. At the stroke of midnight, that buyout dropped to $3 million. That was the one thing I could control, Parker said of the decision Thursday morning to fire Adazio after just two seasons. That lessened the financial impact of it. As a result, the tenure of one of the more curious hires in CSU football history came to an abrupt end. Adazio was let go after a 4-12 record in his 16 games in charge of Rams football. And only 5 days after becoming the first coach in CSU football history to be ejected from a game. That wasn't the outcome that I was expecting, Parker said at a news conference at Canvas Stadium on Thursday afternoon. It wasn't the outcome that I was looking for. It wasn't the tab he was looking for either. Assuming Adazio's replacement is hired this month, CSU will be on the hook for the salaries of three head football coaches during the 2021 calendar year. The Rams must now pay Adazio $3 million, divided in equal monthly installments for the next 3 years, unless Adazio finds another coaching job. If he does, his salary from that job will be subtracted from what CSU owes him. So Parker would love to see his former coach find work, and well-compensated work, as soon as possible. The buyout is not a trivial number by any means, Parker said. It'll be stretched out over the remainder of what Coach Adazio's employment agreement was. So we've got 3 years to manage and mitigate it. The school also paid another ex-football coach, Mike Bobo, who was in charge of the program from 2014 to 2019, a sum of $608,333 this past June 3rd, or past June 30th, and it owes a similar payment next summer. Add on the salary for Adazio's successor that is expected to be at least in the $1.5 million per year range, and the university likely will be paying at least $3 million to three head football coaches, past and present, in 2022. Throw in assistant salaries, Adazio was given a pool of $2.8 million for up to 20 positions, and that total is expected to be closer to $6 million to $7 million in 2022 for all football-related coaches and support staffers. When asked if a booster had stepped forward to cover Adazio's buyout, Parker replied simply, no. Parker said the university will conduct a search for a new coach differently than it did 2 years ago, a process sources say centered largely around university president Joyce McConnell, Parker, and the consultation of current Jacksonville Jaguars coach Urban Meyer, a former CSU football assistant whom Addazio worked for years ago. The university is contracting the services of the Collegiate Sports Associates search firm, which is run by former FBS athletic director Todd Turner. Last time around, we got very focused on someone with head coaching experience, Parker said. I want to really approach this with an open mind and do our best to cast the net far and wide. The CSU administrator said he already had received a lot of interest in the position as of Thursday afternoon. Addazio, who was let go after the 4-12 record with the Rams in one abbreviated season, 1-3 in 2020, and one full season, 3-9 in 2021, was slated to earn $1.6 million in 2022. At 16 games, Addazio's stint as full-time Rams coach is the shortest since George Cassidy posted a 0-5 record in 1910 during Cassidy's only season on the job. The Rams finished the 2021 season on a 6-game losing streak. Crowds dwindled as the losses mounted. CSU's season-ending 52-10 home loss to Nevada on November 27th was played before an announced crowd of 17,465, or just 47% of capacity at Canvas Stadium, over its last three home games against Boise State, Air Force, and Nevada. CSU averaged 22,745 paid customers. The last two seasons, the program didn't give them a lot of experiences that led to belief, Parker said. Many of those fans during the Nevada game left by halftime, which the Rams entered trailing 31-0. Addazio wasn't around for the second half either. In what would be his final game, he was ejected with 4 minutes and 41 seconds left in the second quarter and CSU trailing 28-0. Parker said the ejection did not play a role in the final decision to fire Addazio. Perhaps it was a fitting finale for a coach who sometimes saved his most fiery rhetoric for post-game news conferences. Do I like where we are, Addazio said after a 35-21 home loss to Air Force on November 13th. I'd like to have more wins. But do I like where we are in terms of building this program? Hell yeah. We're going to build this thing one game at a time, one brick at a time. Now the university is asking Addazio to hit the bricks, closing the books on an epoch that felt star-crossed from the start. The former Boston College and Temple coach was hired in December 2019 upon the direct recommendation of Meyer. Addazio, 62, had worked at Notre Dame with Meyer from 1991 to 2001 and was an assistant under Meyer at the University of Florida from 2005 to 2010. We saw a lot of progress, Parker said of Addazio, but you know, a lot of times the progress wasn't measurable from an external perspective. Data suggests 1 in 44 U.S. children affected by autism, by Lindsay Tanner. New autism numbers released Thursday suggest more U.S. children are being diagnosed with the developmental condition and at younger ages. In an analysis of 2018 data from nearly a dozen states, researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that among 8-year-olds, 1 in 44 had been diagnosed with autism. That rate compares with 1 in 54 identified with autism in 2016. U.S. autism numbers have been on the rise for several years, but experts believe that reflects more awareness and wider availability of services to treat the condition, rather than a true increase in the number of affected children. A separate CDC report released Thursday said that children were 50% more likely to be diagnosed with autism by age 4 in 2018 than in 2014. There is some progress being made, and earlier kids get identified, the earlier they can access services they might need to improve their developmental outcome, said CDC researcher and co-author Kelly Shaw. Geraldine Dawson, director of Duke University's Center for Autism and Brain Development, said the new estimate is similar to one found in research based on screening a large population of children rather than on those already diagnosed. As such, she said it may be closer to reflecting the true state of autism in the U.S. children than earlier estimates. The CDC reports are based on data from counties and other communities in 11 states, some with more urban neighborhoods where autism rates tend to be higher. The rates are estimates and do not necessarily reflect the entire U.S. situation, the author said. Autism rates varied widely, from 1 in 26 in California, where services are plentiful, to 1 in 60 in Missouri. Overall, autism prevalence was similar across racial and ethnic lines, but rates were higher among black children in two sites, Maryland and Minnesota. Until recently, U.S. data showed prevalence among white children was higher. At a third site, Utah, rates were higher among children from lower-income families than those from wealthier families, reversing a long-standing trend, said report co-author Amanda Bakian, a University of Utah researcher who oversees the CDC's autism surveillance in that state. Bakian said that likely reflects more coverage for autism services by Medicaid and private health insurers. Boulder King Soopers plans to reopen in January. King Soopers announced Wednesday it will reopen its renovated Table Mesa Drive store January 20th. The South Boulder store was the site of a mass shooting in March where 10 people died. For months, the store has been renovating the site, incorporating feedback from King Soopers employees and community members along the way. We've always known that Boulder was a special place, but you've proven through your empathy, your strength, help, and support that Boulder is so much more than a place. It's more than a community. Boulder is our family, Joe Kelly, King Soopers president, said. We know that the building is just part of what makes this store so special, and that restoring it is another step in the journey as we continue to rebuild and heal. The store's reopening plays a critical, practical role in people's lives, given that it remains many South Boulder residents' grocery store of choice. And the shopping center has long been a community hub for many. Mayor Aaron Brockett noted, the grocery store has been open for nearly 50 years. But it's also of symbolic importance in Boulder's healing journey. It's an important milestone for the community, Brockett said. Boulder Chamber CEO John Tayer agreed. King Soopers provides an important service to our community and has been a longtime neighborhood center, he said. At the same time, it is a milestone in our community's recovery from that very traumatic incident. Before officially announcing a reopening date, King Soopers in November held hiring events to ensure the store will be staffed sufficiently when it opens. The grocery store has said about 50% of its employees who worked there at the store at the time of the shooting intend to return to work there. The store plans to release more information about the redesign and reopening soon. In previous interviews, King Soopers representatives have said the redesign will include changes to the interior and the exterior of the building, as well as a redesign of its parking lot. And that is from Deborah Swearingen of the Daily Camera. From the Heart Enterprises, it's a matter of life and death. Black men dying by suicide at increasing rates in state. Denver man starts nonprofit in attempt to turn the tide, by Elise Schmelzer. Andre Coleman, 16, doesn't fight anymore. When he gets angry now, he steps away or takes a few minutes to flow through some Tai Chi moves he learned from his mentor. He gets some weird looks from classmates if he starts Tai Chi while sitting at their desk at school, but the looks are worth the chance to avoid a fight. It was a new life, he said. I had to learn how to breathe. That's exactly how his mentor, Halim Ali, hopes Coleman and the other young black men under his tutelage will approach challenging situations in the future. Ali founded the nonprofit From the Heart Enterprises to help young black men address the trauma and anger that can turn into isolation, violence, and suicide. Ali is particularly concerned about rising gun violence among teens in Metro Denver, especially after 9 students were wounded in 2 shootings outside a pair of Aurora high schools in 1 week, and about rising suicide rates in the Colorado black male population. It's a matter of life and death, Ali said. The age-adjusted rate of suicide for black men in Colorado has nearly doubled since 2013, when the rate was 10.2 suicides per 100,000. By 2020, that rate grew to 20.2 suicides per 100,000, according to Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment data. National suicide rates among black people peak during adolescence and young adulthood, then decline, according to the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. From the Heart and 2 other Denver organizations, the Crowley Foundation and the Apprentice of Peace Youth Organization, will host a full day of workshops and group sessions Saturday at the Carla Madison Recreation Center for Denver's young men to help them find stability and plan for the future. Attendees will receive a $100 gift card if they complete the full day. The goal is to let all of our men know of the services we provide and to create an open space where men feel like they can talk, he said. I want them to know it's okay to hurt. It's okay to cry. The COVID-19 pandemic created additional complications for young people, Ali said. Many in-school programs, like some of his own, were halted last year when schools went virtual. Students were forced to be at home, even though some homes are not safe or good environments for learning. Staying in touch with some of his mentees became a challenge for Ali. But demand for mental health services for young black men boomed. We were doing a lot of work around crisis, he said. You're either going into crisis, in crisis, or coming out of crisis. In the long term, Ali hopes to raise enough money to create a 24/7 crisis center for men where they can access mental health services, food, meditation spaces, housing services, and workshops on healthy relationships, self-care, and goal planning in a safe and welcoming environment. Too often, men do not access mental health services until they are ordered to by a judge, Ali said. I just see so much happening with our men, he said. Ali sees an undercurrent of anger in all of the young men he mentors. Unresolved trauma from violence, abandonment, and other wounds too often manifest as violence, self-harm, substance use, isolation, and hopelessness, Ali said. But U.S. culture teaches young men, especially black men, to stay silent about their emotions and to shield themselves from vulnerability. We just don't talk about it, Ali said. Coleman grew up believing boys shouldn't cry, no matter what. He spent the first years of his life in foster homes, some of which were abusive, because neither of his parents were able to care for him. He was adopted at age 3 and raised in a loving home in North Park Hill, but struggled. As he got older, he started to get into fights and disciplinary trouble at school. He first started attending mentoring sessions, group retreats, and volunteer days through From the Heart as he entered high school. His teachers at Overland High School were the first to notice a change, Coleman said. It's crucial that young black men have access to mental health treatment and feel comfortable using the services. Adult mentors and mental health providers who come from similar backgrounds as their clients are an important part of that, Ali said. Ali's life experiences as a former gang member, a victim of gun violence, and a person who experienced homelessness and addiction help him connect to the men he works with and prove that it is possible to achieve a healthier life. Having once been a menace to society, I can talk to them, he said. Coleman now constantly checks in with his friends to see how they're really doing beneath their teenage bravado. He encourages them to talk. "They get tired of me," he said with a smile, "but holding it all in, that's a whole different kind of hurt." Retired Justice Hobbs dies at 76. Polis says the impact of his work will continue to be felt across our state. By Shelley Bradbury. Former Colorado Supreme Court Justice Gregory Hobbs Jr. died Tuesday after suffering a pulmonary embolism. The 76-year-old retired justice spent decades working in water law, authored several books, and wrote poetry. He died 2 weeks before his 77th birthday with his family at his side, they said in a statement Wednesday sent out by Water Education Colorado, a nonprofit organization he helped found in 2002 that is dedicated to teaching Coloradans about the state's water issues. Justice Hobbs was a master of water law, a mentor to many Coloradans in the water community who relied on his expertise, and the impact of his work will continue to be felt across our state for years to come, Governor Jared Polis said in a statement on Thursday. After beginning his career as a sixth grade teacher, Hobbs worked as an environmental law and water rights attorney for years in Colorado, with stops at the Environmental Protection Agency and the Natural Resources section of the Colorado Attorney General's Office. He had a huge appreciate for Western culture and often wore bolo ties and turquoise jewelry, said Jayla Poppleton, Executive Director of Water Education Colorado. Often he was probably the most knowledgeable person in the room, but he would defer to listening first and really genuinely wanted to know what other people thought and what they cared about, she said. But he would inject just the right thing at the right time to help steer the conversation or to help us think about things from a very valuable and needed point of view. Hobbs became a partner with Davis, Graham, and Stubbs in 1979 and served as principal counsel for the Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District, the family statement said. In 1992, he founded the law firm Hobbs, Trout, and Rayleigh. Hobbs took the bench of the state's highest court in 1996. He wrote more than 250 majority opinions for the state Supreme Court, many of them on water law, the family statement said. He served until 2015, then continued to work in the courts as a senior water judge after retiring. Hobbs took the bench of the state's highest court. Oops, sorry, we read that already. Justice Hobbs was a unique person who was passionate about law, poetry, photography, and the history and landscape of Colorado, State Supreme Court Chief Justice Brian Boatwright said in a statement Thursday. His affinity for the outdoors and his love for exploration were unmatched, as was his desire to inspire others. Hobbs was enthusiastic and generous, Poppleton said. Every time the nonprofit organization produced a new issue of its publications, he'd declare that issue the best one yet, she said. He meant so much to so many and was really the ultimate public servant, she said. It's impossible to overstate the impact Justice Hobbs had on the state of Colorado and Colorado water. Hobbs shared his joy for life with everyone around him, Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser said Thursday. In 2008, Hobbs published a collection of poetry in the University of Baltimore Law Review. "I find the poetical is another way of describing the experience of a truth by analogy," he wrote then. Hobbs is survived by his wife, Bobby, and two children, Dan and Emily. Our next story, callous lack of humanity. Police officer fired for not giving first aid to victim, by Elise Schmelzer. A Denver police officer failed to provide first aid to a teenage gunshot victim for more than 10 minutes last year, while the 18-year-old bled onto the pavement and pleaded for help before he died, an internal investigation found. The officer, Dwayne Rogers, was fired November 22nd in connection with the September 7th, 2020 incident. Another officer, David Clough, arrived at the scene at the same time and also did not provide first aid first aid, but Clough resigned before the disciplinary investigation finished. The disciplinary letter explaining Rogers' dismissal, obtained by the Denver Post through a public records request, does not name the victim, but coroner reports list Jelante Jones, 18, as the man who died in a shooting on September 7, 2020. It's unknown whether Jones would have lived had Rogers, a 16-year veteran of the force, given first aid. The letter does not state whether Jones died at the scene, but indicates he stopped breathing before paramedics arrived. Mary DeLackey, the Denver Department of Public Safety's Chief Deputy Executive Director, wrote in the disciplinary letter that it would be reasonable to assume Jones would have been alive when paramedics arrived had Rogers acted. At no time did Officer Rogers crouch down near the victim, DeLackey wrote. At no time did Officer Rogers touch the victim. At no time did Officer Rogers offer words of comfort. The callous lack of humanity that Officer Rogers displayed is best exemplified by his response to the victim saying, "Oh my God, help me," when Officer Rogers replied, "Do you live in this complex?" The Denver Police Department said in a statement Thursday that the department opened an internal investigation in the early stages of the homicide investigation after officers had concerns about Rogers' failure to render aid. Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin recommended Rogers be fired, which DeLackey affirmed. The internal investigation was overseen by the Office of the Independent Monitor, the department said. Rogers and Clough responded to a report of shots fired at an apartment complex at 10150 East Harvard Avenue on September 7, 2020, and found a man lying on his back in the parking lot, bleeding from his lower body. Rogers approached the man and requested an ambulance over the radio, while Clough started stringing crime tape around the area. In his report from the night of the incident, Rogers wrote that the victim's pants were so bloody that he couldn't tell which leg was injured. Rogers later told investigators that he completed first aid and tourniquet training classes and generally carried a tourniquet on duty, but he had forgotten it that night. Rogers told investigators he didn't try to find the wound or stop the bleeding because he feared causing more harm to the man. Instead, he decided to talk to the man to try and keep him alert. "I made the determination that I should not touch him because he's in dire straits at this point," Rogers told investigators, according to the letter. "He's bleeding out. He can barely move, and he can barely talk to me at all. With all that going on, I made the determination that I can't touch him. I didn't want to fish around for the injury and do more harm." Rogers' body camera recorded him speaking with Jones for minutes. He repeatedly asked Jones who shot him and what his name was. Jones did not often respond, but when he did, he repeatedly said, "I'm dying," or "I can't breathe." Minutes into their interaction, Rogers asked the victim, "Are you going to tell me what happened? Do you know what happened?" "Oh my God, help me," Jones responded. Rogers' camera footage shows he did not provide any medical aid to Jones for the more than 10 minutes he was on the scene prior to the arrival of Denver Fire, according to the letter. Twice he walked away from the bleeding man. Rogers never informed dispatchers that the man's health was deteriorating, asked Clough whether he had a tourniquet, or requested an officer with a tourniquet come to the scene. Rogers also only asked the victim once where he had been shot. Officer Rogers claimed that he was concerned about aggravating the injury, cannot excuse the lack of care he demonstrated, since the foreseeable outcome of failing to render aid was death, which significantly outweighs any concern of aggravating an injury, DeLackey wrote. Clough told investigators that he assessed the victim's injuries as life-threatening, but assumed Rogers was applying first aid. The day Rogers was fired for his inaction that day in 2020, he was simultaneously fired for not complying with the city's COVID-19 vaccine mandate, records show. Denver police arrested a suspect in Jones' death on September 8, 2020, the day after the shooting. Online court records show the suspect, DeAndre Horton, was charged with four counts of first-degree murder, but the prosecutors dismissed those charges. Horton pleaded guilty to first-degree assault in October and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And the Denver Post has several obituaries today, so I will read the basics from those. Frank Ankeley, born May 14, 1929, and died November 22, 2021. A rosary will take place on December 6th at 7 p.m. at Horan and McConaty on Federal Boulevard in Denver. Funeral mass will be December 7th at 11 a.m. at St. Cajetan Catholic Church on Raleigh Street in Denver. Burial to follow at Mount Olivet. You can see HoranCares.com for the full obituary. Grace Bond, born June 11, 1920, and died November 24, 2021. Grace S. Bond was the loving wife of John R. Bond for 74 years, mother of four, grandmother of 10, great-grandmother of 10. For full obituary, please visit FairmountFuneralHome.com. In lieu of flowers, please consider donating to wingsmuseum.org. Robert Coutts, born October 2, 1941, and died November 25, 2021. Robert Bob Thomas Coutts, 80, of Denver, Colorado, transitioned peacefully at home. He was born in Lazier, Colorado, the son of Thomas and Mary Coutts. Bob is survived by his sister, Martha Todd of Montrose, Colorado, and by his two daughters and their spouses, Dana and Ann Shimkus, Kristen Engelke and Robert, and grandchildren, Ty Engelke and Molly Engelke, all of Denver. He was preceded in death by his brother, James, and his parents. To read the full obituary, you can go to obituaries.easycremation.com. In keeping with Bob's wishes, no memorial service will be scheduled. Contributions may be made in Bob's name to the Denver Dumb Friends League at ddfl.org. Mary Louise Levenhagen Marquardt, born May 5, 1931, and died November 10, 2021. Mary Lou Marquardt was born at her grandparents' home in Decatur, Arkansas, to Clarence and Agnes Levenhagen. She was raised in Estes Park and Denver, Colorado. She passed away at home surrounded by her loving family. She was preceded in death by her husband, Roger Marquardt, son Brian Malkin, sisters Carol Nicholas and Judy Fern. She is survived by her sister, Linda McTavish, daughters Kathy Hinger, Terry Slivka, Nancy Spera, and Edna Baptist, sons Robert Malkin and Alan Marquardt, 11 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. Donations may be sent to Marantha International, 3ABN, or Hospice of La Junta, Sangre de Cristo. On Sunday, November 21, 2021, Sean Thomas Sanders, Shawnee T., passed away at the age of 32. Sean was born on August 16, 1989, in Indian Hills, Colorado, to Scott Sanders and Karen Sanders. Sean was predeceased by his grandparents Gary and Beverly Sanders, Granny and Pa, his grandpa John Miller, Papa John, his cousin Ryan White, and his dog Bandit. Sean is survived by his soulmate and fiance Quinn Olson, his best friend and brother Kelly Sanders, his devoted mother, Karen Sanders, his father, Scott Jody Sanders, his grandmother, Barbara Miller, countless family members, friends, and his dog, Aggie. A celebration of Sean's life will be held at a later date. Elsie Jean Sargent, born November 30th, 1939, and died November 23rd, 2021. E. Jean Sargent, 81, of Broomfield, passed away November 23rd. She is survived by her husband, Dr. Wayne A. Sargent, four children and 12 grandchildren. Please visit FairmountFuneralHome.com for service information and full obituary. Verlene Jean Spatz, 88, of Highlands Ranch, Colorado, died August 23, 2021. A memorial celebration will be held 11:30 a.m. on Saturday, December 4th at Heffelbauer Funeral Services on Ridgeline Boulevard in Highlands Ranch. Jean is survived by his wife, Patricia Ann Spatz, sister Carolyn Davidson, daughter-in-law Carol Spatz, and grandchildren Philip and Elizabeth Spatz, and many nieces and nephews in the Kansas City area. He is preceded in death by his beloved only son, Kevin Allen Spatz. For the full obituary, head to the Heffelbauer website. Arthur Art Alejandro Vigil, born on July 12, 1944, and died November 28, 2021. After spending time at home with his family and under Abode Hospice Comfort Care. He was born July 12, 1944, married on June 8, 1963, ordained as a permanent deacon for the Catholic Church on April 15, 1978, and retired from the U.S. Mint in 1993. He also had his real estate broker's license. Arthur is survived by his spouse of 58 years, Celia V. Hill, and their five sons, Arthur K. V. Hill, Andrew M. V. Hill, Christopher J. V. Hill, Leofredo A. V. Hill, and Juan C. V. Hill. He was blessed with 11 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. Art was preceded in death by his father, Leofredo V. Hill, and his mother, Ramoncita Maris. He also leaves behind his siblings, Anacito V. Hill, Ideen Manzanares, Esperanza Smith, Orlando V. Hill, Dilfredo V. Hill, and Tom V. Hill. Services are as follows. Sunday, December 5th at 2 p.m., viewing. 3 p.m., V. Hill and Office of the Dead to include the Rosary, location Romero Funeral Home on Sheridan in Denver. All are welcome to attend. Mass of Christian Burial, Monday, December 6th at 10 a.m., All Saints Catholic Church on South Federal Boulevard in Denver. Archbishop Samuel Aquila, celebrant. Reception to follow in the parish hall. He will be laid to rest at La Florida Cemetery in Antonito, Colorado, on Tuesday, December 7th. In lieu of flowers, the family requests any donations be made to the Parkinson's Association of the Rockies at parkinsonrockies.org. And turning back to news, UK court backs Meghan in dispute over privacy. Dateline London. The Duchess of Sussex won the latest stage in her privacy lawsuit against a British newspaper Thursday, when three senior judges ruled its publisher breached their privacy by reproducing parts of a letter she wrote to her estranged father. The Duchess, formerly known as actress Meghan Markle, said the Court of Appeal ruling was a victory of right versus wrong. She issued a call to reshape a tabloid industry that has long been the bane of celebrities and British royals. And an ad with a vaccinated Santa that drew 5,000 complaints was cleared by regulators. This is by Tiffany Sue of the New York Times. A commercial for supermarket chain Tesco featuring Santa Claus wielding a vaccine passport was deemed acceptable by British advertising regulators after viewers submitted a near record number of complaints that the spot promoted vaccination. Most of the 5,000 complaints received claimed that the ad, which was posted in mid-November, tried to pressure viewers into getting vaccines and encouraged medical discrimination based on vaccine status, according to the Advertising Standards Authority. Toby King, a spokesperson for the agency, said Thursday, "The commercial doesn't break our rules, and there are no grounds for further action." The Tesco ad, created by the Bartle Bogle Hegarty Ad Agency and set to a rendition of the Queen song Don't Stop Me Now, shows people prevailing through various obstacles, a blackout, a closed mall, a produce shortage that leaves a snowman with an eggplant for a nose, to celebrate Christmas. A television news anchor announces at one point that Santa might be quarantined, but then he shows proof of vaccination to a border control control agent inspiring cheers. While we understand that some people disagree with the vaccine program and may find the ad in poor taste, we have concluded that the ad is unlikely to be seen as irresponsible or cause serious or widespread offense on the basis suggested, King said. Tesco said in a statement the ad took a lighthearted view on how the nation is feeling. And in upcoming local events, check out the 9 News Parade of Lights, the city's biggest holiday parade and one that's free to watch along the winding parade route. It begins at the city and county building and snakes through downtown, with maps and details available at winterindenver.com/parade. The 40-float parade, which will be rebroadcast throughout December, starts at 6 p.m. on Saturday, December 4th. And that was written by John Wenzel. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.
One of the major takeaways from last month's big climate conference in Scotland is all levels of government need to collaborate to address climate change. One small New York community is trying to do just that. Hastings-on-Hudson is 20 miles north of New York City, on the banks of the Hudson River. Due to more frequent extreme weather events, Mayor Nikki Armacost says flooding has become a repeat concern. So the town has adopted a climate emergency declaration, working with Westchester County to reduce greenhouse gases. Armacost says it's critical, even for small towns, to take climate change seriously because it's increasingly becoming something they have to deal with.
Arguably, it's one of the number one concerns of municipalities, big or small, and it's a direction that we should all be moving in. It's really, really important for our children, our children's children, for future generations, that we do whatever we can to address this issue.
She says the village is now working to draft a climate action plan with a focus on sustainable transportation and energy-efficient buildings. As the COP26 climate conference ended, the U.S. branch of the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives released research on realistic pathways local governments can take to reduce per capita emissions by 63% or more by 2030 in order to meet Paris Climate Agreement goals. Angie Fife with the council says one way is through what's known as community choice aggregation, which allows governments to have a say in their local energy supplier.
That's a great way for a city to really lead by example and really demonstrate to the community that they're not only taking action themselves towards local environmental goals, but oftentimes these strategies will reduce the cost of operating city government.
She says Hastings-on-Hudson, which is powered by Sustainable Westchester, is among many New York towns that participate in community choice aggregation. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
From the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. It's true, rural America helps feed the world, but people go hungry there too. Many agencies that could help lack the tools needed to reach those populations.
We know that if you're in Lexington, Kentucky, or if you're in Atlanta, Georgia, you have resources that you don't necessarily have out in rural areas.
Matt Levine with the National Foundation to End Senior Hunger says in 2019, more than 5 million Americans age 60 and over went without meals at some point. That's exacerbated with distance.
When there's 20 miles between houses, it's much more difficult to tackle senior hunger.
The pandemic worsened food insecurity, but Levine hopes lessons learned can reduce food insecure households in future public health emergencies. Funds from the $1 trillion infrastructure package will soon be flowing to states, but it takes money to make money, whether it's having enough grant writers or the funds needed for matching grant requirements. Stateline reporter Aaliyah Wright says local officials are worried they'll miss out.
They didn't know if they should actually go after the funds because of past experiences with trying to get federal money.
The infrastructure bill could provide rural communities with cash to fix crumbling roads and bridges. Wright says officials want help from their state governments to make it so.
Hey, we are a small community in your state. We need help. to ensure that we are able to get some of the funds that will be coming to the state.
Consistent polling shows 67% of Americans want abortion to remain safe and legal, so advocates are nervously watching what happens in courts across the country. In Montana's Supreme Court, they will rule on state legislation that prohibits abortions after 20 weeks and bans abortion medication via telehealth and mail prescriptions.
If you think about Montana that has some rural counties with less than 1,000 people in them.
Martha Stahl runs Planned Parenthood of Montana that has sued to stop the laws from taking effect. The United States has one of the highest maternal mortality rates among developed countries, and death rates are highest in states with the lowest access to abortion. Kate Kagawa of the Susan Wicklund Fund serves those who need reproductive health care. She says further restrictions hit rural populations hardest, and the health issue has become politicized unnecessarily.
Over half of our clients already have children. They come from all political parties.
A new podcast is challenging national stereotypes, the urban versus rural divide.
I'm reclaiming and reframing what rural is that the larger media can't really do.
Megan Torgerson hosts Reframing Rural to help counteract depictions of those living in the countryside versus urban centers.
That didn't resonate with how I grew up or the family or friends that I have in rural areas.
For the Yonder Report and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
Attention AINC listeners, we are so excited to announce that all of your favorite programs are now available on all major streaming platforms, including Spotify and Apple Music. Listen, subscribe, and follow AINC today.